Just a little bit of background and context. They've been doing their ministry for over 30 years. And essentially, they teach stewardship of the land, the ground, particularly those who are dependent upon their land for their subsistence. There are 500 million farmers in Africa. So that gives you some idea of the huge need. For those of you who don't know where Zimbabwe is, it is just north of South Africa. So if you get to South Africa and head up north, you'll get there. It was originally called Rhodesia. And Craig is third generation Rhodesian, actually fought in the Bush Wars when Rhodesia was fighting for their independence. So I want to give you a formal introduction of Craig, and then I'll turn it over to him. He's the CEO of Foundations for Farming, which was started in the 80s by Brian Oldreeve, who is the founder of that organization. Craig was born in Rhodesia, and together with his wife, Bridgie, they farmed commercially for 30 years. They were primarily exporting citrus, mangoes, and passion fruit around the world. The farm grew in success and profitability until Craig and his family were removed forcibly by the government from their farm without compensation in President Mugabe's land redistribution program. The Lord took Craig and Bridgie on a remarkable road of forgiveness, which culminated in Craig being led by the Lord to use his talents as a farmer to serve the world's poorest farmers. They have two children. One is a doctor in Cape Town. The other, their son, is a commodities trader in Geneva, Switzerland. I've asked Craig to cover three topics in a short period of time that we have tonight. The first one is to talk about the road to forgiveness. As he will tell you, it's easy to read that as a sermon point. It's a lot harder to put it into practice when the government takes everything you have. I think it's one of the more remarkable examples of living the gospel that I know. And you'll hear about it tonight and all the detail. I've also asked him to share what it's like to go through an economic collapse and to survive that with God's grace and with his sovereign control over all things that have to do with how you make it through that situation. He'll also talk about being a pioneer in sustainable agriculture and the incredible impact that has on the poor. There's a book about Craig and Brian called The Story Within a Story. It's about 40 pages long. There are 14 million people in Zimbabwe. At the peak of their economic power, they were on par with the British pound. That currency was worth more than a U.S. dollar. And there were 250,000 white Zimbabweans in the country. Today, there are 20,000 Zimbabweans, white Zimbabweans left. Most of them have fled. And Craig Deal and his family are ones that have chosen not to. To live out the gospel to the people who have essentially rejected them in every possible way. So I'd like you to give a big welcome to Craig Deal.
Thank you, everybody, for turning out tonight. I'm so honored to be able to be in the States and to visit with you guys, y'all, as you say down here. And most folks that I meet here in the States will say to me, well, what are you doing in Zimbabwe? What made you go to Zimbabwe? Well, the trouble is I was born there, so I didn't have much option, and I'm actually third generation. So there is a white tribe that lives in Africa, just privileged to be used by God in the circumstances that God put us through. And so, once again, just thank you so much for your warm welcome, and everywhere I've traveled in the States, this trip has been absolutely outstanding, and I just so love the people and love the way you welcome guys. And I also just honor the United States for the way they've sent out missionaries all over the world. And we always looked at the U.S. as sort of the beacon of Christianity from our standpoint, and just hoping that I'm be able to sow back into America from Africa in my small little way. So, guys from my country with hair like mine, white hair, we've had the privilege of living through the fastest growing economy on the planet in the 60s. It was the fastest, most successful growing economy on the planet at the time, and the engine room of that was tobacco and agriculture. I also have the dubious distinction and privilege of living through the second fastest collapsing economy in the history of the planet, and that was in 2008. So in one generation, I've seen it all. And so, as Chuck said, I was born in Zimbabwe. My father opened up a virgin farm out of virgin bush in 1948. He was a returning serviceman from the Second World War. He flew Spitfires. And he came back and he started to farm. He was born in Rhodesia, as it was then, and he went off and to the war and then came back and then opened up this farm. It was just bush. So that was the first house that I ever known and the only home I ever knew in my life. But my dad died when I was 14, so two things happened then. I lost the dream of going farming. And without a father figure, I went into quite serious rebellion. I could wrap my mother around my little finger, and because of that, went into a really rebellious teenage lifestyle. What happened was, we went through school, and then when I finished school, we were all conscripted into the armed forces. So I went with everybody else, and we were part of the war, a war of liberation in Rhodesia, turning into Zimbabwe. And it was during that time that I had my first experience of God. Up to then, in my rebellious years, I had like two passions in my life. One was drinking beer, and the second was persecuting Christians. I thought Christians were a real weak, kneed, lily-livered, especially the men. I just thought they were beyond it. Anyway, so I did my best to put them down. But I had an experience in the war where I was walking with a group of men, and we walked into a very close-range ambush. And the man next door to me took 7 bullets, and we fought our way out of it, and I was lucky. But about 6 months after that, my brother came to me. My brother had become a believer. And he came to me, and he said he met a little old lady in church, in his church, and she said, "Are you Craig Deal's brother?" And he said, "Yes." And she said to him, "Please, can you ask him what he was doing at 5 to 9 on the 7th of December?" And so my brother said to me, "What were you doing at 5 to 9 on the 7th of December?" Well, I knew exactly that minute, because that was when the bullets started to fly. That's when we walked into this ambush. And what this little old lady, she was a matron at a boarding school that I was at. She was nothing to me. I probably just terrorized her. And I was just one of thousands of kids that went through her hostel. So there was no connection with her at all. But she had an unction from the Lord at that minute to get on her knees and pray for me. And she did. And I, in my rebellion, just slapped Jesus in the face and said, "This is mumbo jumbo. I don't believe it. It's just coincidence." Got on with my life. And I just never got a chance. That lady went to her grave without knowing the great impact what she had done. And I know that one day I'll be able to thank her in heaven, but just a lesson here: if you feel an unction to pray for someone, do it, because God's laid it on your heart for a reason. And you'll never know this side of eternity what you've actually done. So anyway, I got on with my lifestyle. So the Lord couldn't get hold of me through violence, so he tried another tactic, and I fell in love with a Christian girl. And she, thank goodness for her disobedience, she married me. Because, you know, the Bible says you should not be unequally yoked. And it's there for a reason, because it was brutal. And but she hung in with me. And I just want to honor my precious Bridgie right now, that she hung in with me through thick and thin, where she could have easily abandoned me. And so it was a very precious wife that God gave me. Anyway, when the children started to come along, and I could see the way that she used to take them off for prayers and read them Bible stories and tuck them up at night and all that. And I just realized that the way we were bringing up children, one of us was right and one of us was wrong. And so it was through that, through the influence of having a godly woman in your house. She never preached at me, she never forced me to go to church, but just her witness in the home slowly turned this great big ship around. And I began to see who God really was through her. She did then something really naughty. She ambushed me one evening. She said we were going to a barbecue. So I rocked up at the barbecue with my six-pack, and all the other men there had Bibles. So it was actually a Bible study in disguise, and they had connived to get me there. But the Bible study was led by a Baptist missionary from the States, and just a wonderful man of God. And then I just saw all these men, that they were normal men. And they were just men, and they loved me, and we didn't get into anything heavily, superly spiritual or anything, but through that experience and through my wife, that pastor eventually led me to the Lord and baptized me. So I was now, by now, we were really successful farmers. I'd built up a big, what had happened, when I left school, I went and worked for the guy who had bought the farm off my mum after my dad had died. And I went back and worked for this man and then bought the farm back from him. So it was an expensive way of inheriting a farm, but nevertheless I ended up in the same house that I was born and back on my old farm. And then we started to really get successful. I had a real fierce ambition about me and a prideful type arrogance that I could do anything. And we built and we built and we built. And we built this big empire. We were exporting citrus fruits all around the world and getting really successful financially, and just we had like 1,000 people on the farm who worked for us. And so it was a big, big operation, and the empire just grew and grew and grew. So when I had this experience and I wearily laid myself before the Lord, so now I was a successful farmer, but now I was a successful Christian farmer. But not much changed. You see, ambition can get in the way. And I continued to build, and I continued to build, and yes, I had a different outlook on life, but didn't really put the gospel on my feet. And I did all the churchy things and was compassionate, and I built a little church on the farm for our workers, and I did all the right stuff, but the reality of Jesus and who he is hadn't really sunk in so deep. When I look back at that period in my life, I would like to have considered myself as a Christian streaker. I had the helmet of salvation and nothing else on. So we became really successful and we just, as I say, empire building and a lot of self, like rather like that parable of the rich farmer, storing, building more storage and getting richer and richer. I love the Message version of that parable. It's called the greedy farmer. I think that was me. But then in the year 2000, everything changed. Zimbabwe had been independent for 20 years, and Robert Mugabe, when he came into power, promised us that the white farmers were still very welcome because we were feeding not only Zimbabwe but the nations around us, and he encouraged us to stay. A lot of my compatriots fled at independence, fearing retributions and stuff, but we stayed on and we built and built, and probably 80% of the farms changed hands during that period, from one farmer to another. But you always had to offer it to the government first, whether they wanted the land. If they wanted it first, they had a first right to buy every farm that ever changed hands. So they had an opportunity to buy 80% of the farms, and they passed that up. They didn't. And so we got on with our lives. And but then in 2000, there was an election looming, and our president got a bit jittery. He saw that the electorate were getting a bit, up to then it had been like a one-party state, but he could see the electorate was getting a bit jittery. And maybe he had a chance of losing an election for the first time. So he had been in power 20 years, and so when he did all his calculations, he realized that the swing vote for him getting back into power was the farm workers on the commercial farms. There were 300,000 families that lived on the farms. And he realized that he felt that perhaps we as farm owners would sway them one way or the other. So he had to, the only way he could do that was to neutralize them, and the only way he could neutralize them was just a blanket cleansing of all white farmers out of the country. And so he did that in a very systematic and cruel and well thought out planned way. So in March 2000, he unleashed militia on all of us. And we had no recourse. We had been masters of our own destiny. We were folks that could defend ourselves. We were folks that, because of our pride, and we were self-congratulatory, we were quite a built-up community. But suddenly we were headless chickens. We had no place to turn. And these militia would just sit on us, on our farms, where they would come in and just move into your house, take your equipment, take your crops, take everything, and just kick you out, basically. And there was no rule of law. The police, we couldn't go to the police, we couldn't call on the army, you can't call your local politician. Everybody was just focused against us. And so we went through a period of absolute mayhem. And from being very in charge of our own destiny people, we suddenly were just at a total loss. It was like we just didn't know what to do. We didn't know what had hit us. And so they used to get young people and put them into all-night, what they used to call pungwis, which were indoctrination classes, and give them marijuana and stuff and get them fired up so that they would come out in the day without much feeling and much thought and just move us off our farms. So I was the leader of our community at that time. I was the chairman of our little group with 30 or 40 farms that I was looking after. And the first couple of weeks of March, this state-sponsored was just unleashed on us. And we were in the middle of our harvest. It was an important time for farmers. And we just couldn't farm because everything was just being taken away from us, left, right, and center. The crops were taken. Anyway, so it was systematic, and they were moving through the areas. And being the leader of the community, I would have to go to each situation. And there would be an unruly mob there, and there'd be a frightened farmer and his family, and not knowing what to do. And I would go and try and defuse the tension and at least make sure that there was no loss of life or anything too violent. I did this for about a week and came home one night, and my wife Bridgie, she was on the radio, CB radio, and she was saying, there's another one here, go there, go there. And the place was just a mess. It was just, it was the whole country, and it was just a raging lawlessness. With no recourse to the law. The judiciary were cleaned out. Title deeds meant nothing. The cornerstone of a democracy is your title deeds. Those were just cancelled overnight, so we didn't own anything. And then, I came back one evening and I was just really tired, and I sat down in my chair and I said to Bridgie, what's going to happen when they come to us? What are we going to do? What's going to be our tactic? And she calmly and matter-of-factly said, well, what we'll do is we'll pray with them. That actually wasn't what I was thinking. we discussed it a bit, and I, from the comfort of my armchair that night, I said, okay, Lord, we'll do that. I'll pray with them. But I flicked up a little proviso prayer, because of all the groups that were going around our district, some you were a bit more reasonable than others, and you could discuss things with them, others you couldn't. And there was two particular gentlemen who were leading quite a big gang. They were completely and utterly unreasonable and rabid and hostile. And so I said to the Lord, yes, I'll do it, but please don't send me those two. That was another mistake, because Monday these guys were in our house, and they came with their big gang, and I ended up, they came up and they politely told me that I had 24 hours to go, if you didn't adhere to that, you would go right now, maybe. So, in a box, I don't know. But anyway, but I was at a crossroads time. You know, was I going to do what I'd promised God? Or was I going to find another alternative? Had plenty of choices. Anyway, the Holy Spirit in me, I just went up to these two guys and I put my hands on their shoulder. They just saw me purposely walking up to them, and I put my hands on their shoulder. And I said, I want to pray with you. And the first miracle happened, because they said, okay. They were a bit shocked, so they said, okay. And so we held hands, and my little wife came out, and we held hands with these two guys, and I prayed a very simple 45-second prayer, nothing super spiritual or anything. And we unlocked our hands, and I opened my eyes, and in front of me, two lions had turned into lambs. They just looked up at me and they said, Mr. Deal, we're going now. And they turned on tail and they took their gang with them. And the miracle of that story, those two men were never seen again. All my other farming friends were waiting, and they were saying, where are they? What's happened to them? And they said, what did you do with them? You know, maybe thought I don't know what they thought I'd done with them, but... I said, I don't know, all I did. And they said, what did you do? I said, we just prayed with them. And they left. And which they did, an absolute miracle. But for me, what God did in me that day, that was the important thing. Because for the first time, I'd really seen the power of God firsthand in my face, proper. And I was able to accept that. And so we managed, our farm got cut up smaller and smaller and smaller until we were just swamped. Little plot holders all around us and right up to our fence. And we managed to stick around for 3 years after that, but we had scores and scores and scores of those type of incidences where another group would come and want to kick us out, then another group. And every time we would invite them in, we'd give them a cup of tea, we'd pray with them, and every time they would go. We never passed a bribe, we never paid them off, we gave them a shone a Bible and they would go. That's, and I just saw this over and over and over again. Eventually, and it just got very untenable, really, to stay there. We were attacked all the time. My wife had a man with a machete come into the kitchen when she was cooking one day, and we had people just threatening us, and it was a hard 3 years to try and hold the line there. And eventually the bit of sanity came and they said to us, yeah, you can stay, but we're going to need some incentive for you to stay. And that meant we would have had to start bribing. So we vacated our last little bit of land voluntarily. But that three-year reprieve allowed us to focus on a life after farming. And we were able to collect some money, and we were able to, you won't believe this, but we had to sneak our tractors off the farm and sell them. And we had to really steal our own stuff back at night and take it back. And then, so that gave me a bit of money to be able to buy a house in the city and sort of prepare for life without a farm. And so you realize that when that happens, you don't just lose, we lost our home, we lost our business, we lost our future in one go. And you just, a lot of the farmers that were with me, they were left with a shirt on their back and nothing else. And even everything, even your furniture and your everything was just appropriated and taken. So, but what God had done in me was just triggered in my wife and I, and I need to honor my family here. My two children were sort of college age, leaving school and going to university, and they didn't understand what was going on, but they stood with me. We stood as a family. They sometimes didn't understand what we were doing, but both my children just stood with me and never questioned what we were doing. So this started a road of absolute forgiveness in our hearts, where today I can say to you, I have no bitterness, no angst, no unforgiveness towards our government, towards the people who took the farm. God did it, I didn't. In the flesh, you can't do this. You don't wake up one day and feel forgivy. God does it. And even today, when I have little twinges of guilt, I have sadness, but I don't have any unforgiveness left in me. And that was just God at work. It wasn't anything that I planned or wanted to do. But you have to, in this forgiveness story, you have to make a conscious decision to forgive. It doesn't come naturally. It's not in your flesh to be able to forgive. It's something that God does in you. And He took us on this road. It was slow and it was hard. And I was not a Christian streaker anymore. I was getting quite serious about God. And I scoured the scriptures to see if there was some sort of get-out clause for this forgiveness thing. Surely it doesn't apply to me. We're feeding a whole nation here. Surely it doesn't affect mean Christians. But, you know, you go to Matthew 5, and those words that are in red, Jesus says them, and there's no room for speculation. He tells you, turn the other cheek. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If your enemy is thirsty, give him something to drink. And says that if a man steals your tunic, give him your coat as well. And so in our context, that was, if a man steals your farm, teach him how to farm. And so that's what we did. There was just no out of this forgiveness. And once you realize that, and you start actually practicing it and putting it into practice, because it doesn't come naturally, like I said, I had a little trigger movement that I picked up in a book somewhere, where if a man cuts you off in the traffic, if a man offends you, or if a man steals your farm, whatever it is, take that offense. Take it and leave it at the foot of the cross. And that's what we learned to do. We just, whatever it was, and the big thing in our lives, we suddenly had nothing. No offense, leave it at the foot of the cross. Now, the issue is between Jesus and him. That person doesn't even owe me an apology. Because I've left it, and I've left it at the foot of the cross, and now belongs to Jesus. And you know what happens? The burden just lifts when you do that. The burden lifts, sets the prisoner free. You realize you are the prisoner. And you realize that holding on to your angst and unforgiveness, just like drinking poison and hoping the other guy's going to die, we just do it. We did it over and over and over until it became second nature. It's not our problem. The man doesn't even owe us an apology. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. He will deal with him in his good time. And then I don't lose sleep anymore. And so we got to a stage very quickly where we don't hold any angst against those that destroyed our lives at the time. So we say that I can actually, speaking to anybody, I can say that for what God did in my heart during that time. And it's heart surgery, sometimes without an anesthetic, but God gets in there and He changes your heart. And for what God did in my heart, I can honestly say it was worth losing my farm. And we have a saying amongst us now, I once had a farm in Africa, now Africa is my farm. He's given us a much wider scope. And so now I've dedicated the rest of my life to serving the rural poor in Africa. Instead of empire building and trying to rule over Africa, I now am here and I just want to serve Africa and her people. And sometimes folks are, you don't feel like forgiving people. Sometimes people are unforgivable. But the greatest act, form of love, I think, is to be able to forgive someone who doesn't deserve forgiving. That's an act of love. That's what Jesus did to us. The very least we can do is do it back to our fellow man. Easier said than done, but it's not a thing that you can do within your flesh. God has to do that heart surgery deep within you. And then, so now we found ourselves in the city. We didn't really know how to live in the city. We didn't really relate to city folks very well. And so we were in a house in town, and at a loose end. I had no work, didn't know what our future looked like. Lost everything, only thing that I'd ever known. And so we had tears. My wife and I had, we used to cry long into the night and just wonder, what's happened to us? Why has this happened? And so we had serious tears. But the Bible tells you, sow in your tears. Because sowing in your tears is just, again, opposite to your flesh. Who wants to sow when you're in that state? But if you sow, Bible promises you'll reap songs of joy. And this forgiveness thing, you can go through it, and you know those verses in the Bible that said, feed your enemy. It doesn't make sense. Why should I feed my enemy? It's going to make him stronger to come and kill me. But Jesus says, just do what I say and watch what I'll do. Just obedience. Do what I say and watch what I'll do. And so we just did what he said, and I can honestly say we're now watching what he's done, and we're reaping songs of joy. And being with you folks today is one of those songs of joy. Something that I would have never done or dreamed of in my life had I been empire building for myself. Now I'm serving others, and the joy that comes with that, and being here is a testimony to that absolute joy, and the love of the Lord as he. So I look back on our time that we just were under the chastening hand of God. What a privilege to be chastened by God, because three times in the Bible he says, I chasten those whom I love. So he loved me enough to chasten me and knock the pride out of me and the selfishness out of me, to be able to use me in a place where I'm for his service. When we left the farm, we went through so many dramatic times. The day we left the farm, I grabbed all our workers, and Bridgie and I sat before them, and we washed every foot and thanked them for the time we'd had with them. Some of them had been with us for 20, 30 years. And we were parting ways, and they didn't know their future because they were now unemployed. But we were able to just show them the love of Jesus in a real and tangible way, which I hadn't done before. I thought I loved my workers, but I realized I just loved their productivity. I loved how much money they could make for me. And it was rather like Adam was given dominion over the land. God said, take dominion over the land. And then the second Adam, Jesus, came along and he said, love the people. Looking back, I think I had it the other way around. I loved the land and ruled the people. And so I was given a brand new perspective of people, and especially poor people. God distilled in my heart a love for the poor, and set me on this path of, with Foundations for Farming, making a plan for the poor, and that's what we've dedicated our lives to. But When the land is transitioned from faithful users to unfaithful users, there's a consequence. You know, the land was the first thing Adam was given to do in the garden. He wasn't asked to build a factory or dig for diamonds. He was asked to tend the land. And so the land and agriculture is very important to God. And if you're faithful with the first resource God gives you, any nation, God adds. Parable of the talents. God adds. So if you're faithful with the first resource he gives you, which is the land, he adds to you mining, manufacturing, industry, commerce, service providers, all that kind of thing. But it's the faithfulness on the land that triggers it all. Your forefathers, 80% of them were farmers. They were faithful with the first resource God gave this nation. And so God adds, and you end up with the most powerful economy on the planet has ever seen. And I submit to you, it's because of your forefathers were faithful with the land to begin with. If you are unfaithful with the land, parable of the talents, God takes away and you get collapse. So our country spiraled into collapse because as a farming nation, for every dollar I spent on the farm, there were $3 spent on either side of the farm, either in service provision or inputs or something like that. So you take the $1 out, you're actually taking $4 out of the economy. And we suddenly nosedived into a spiral of absolute collapse. Starting in 2000, up until 2001, Zimbabwe had never, ever experienced a famine. Since the transition of the land from faithful users to unfaithful users, we haven't fed ourselves once. We've been in total famine ever since then. And it's nothing to do with color of skin or anything. It's just to do with faithfulness on the land. That God would want us to steward the first resource he's given us. And me as a farmer beforehand, I was very wicked. But you know, it rains on the just and the unjust. And God, the parable of the talents, I believe, applies whether you're a believer or not. God responds to faithfulness. And so when you're faithful, God adds, and you don't have a famine in a country. So Zimbabwe spiraled into the greatest collapse that this modern world has ever seen. Like Chuck said, we were stronger than the US dollar, and we ended up with that note that you've seen there as being our biggest currency, bearing in mind that's $100 trillion. Before that, they had taken off 12 zeros. So it was actually, well, that would have been a something octillion dollar note had they not taken off. You'd wake up one day, and what was one day $1 million, the next day was zero. Was one, I mean. Prices, and they just couldn't keep up. The printing press couldn't print money quick enough. Our inflation was 89.6%. Prices were changing hourly. They were doubling every 23 hours or something like that. There was just, if you got paid today, you had to spend it within 10 minutes because 20 minutes, in an hour's time, it would have lost its value. There was just chaos. We started to barter. You'd swap a chicken for a gallon of petrol, something like that. And there was just nothing in the shops. There was nothing in the queues and queues for gas and petrol and diesel. And it was a time where you had to walk with God. You couldn't rely on anything. We learned to walk daily, minute by minute, with the Lord because you didn't survive any other way. Bridgie and I had painstakingly put money into pension retirement policies, six of them, for the last 25 years. And it was a tough thing every month finding that money to put away into savings. We did it for 25 years. And when the collapse happened, we had to cash it in. It was just enough money to take us out to dinner. Our entire life savings took us out to dinner. And I remember that, I don't know what it was that time, but another time we did go out and we needed to tip the waiter. And we didn't have $5 billion to tip him with. And so she pulled out scratched around in her handbag, and she pulled out a paracetamol, which is a headache tablet. And she said, "Can I give you this as a tip?" He was delighted. He was over the moon, because you couldn't get those kind of things. So we tipped him in one pill. And for him, it was an absolute delight that he had a pill. And so there were times when, obviously, there was no electricity and there were just extreme shortages. And if I happened to want to go for a cup of coffee, I'd have to take a bag about that size full of money and lug these things around with you. And you'd plunk it on the table. Or you go to the supermarket and the checkout clerk, you'd have a few items and the money was tied up into what we called bricks. They looked like bricks. So each brick had 1,000 notes in it. And so there's 1,000 notes and they're all, say, $5 billion each. And so she'd say, "Will you owe us this?" And we'd give her the brick and she'd look at it and she'd say, "Well, that roughly looks like it." And she had a big box between her legs and she'd throw it into the box between her legs. And when the box filled up, she'd call a trolley guy and fill the trolley up with money. And you'd see the guy scooting down the street towards the bank with a trolley, a supermarket trolley, but just full of money. And nobody would ever try and steal it because the trolley was worth much more than the money that was inside. And so then the poor old bank clerk, he was the one who had these very fancy Chinese money counters. He'd have to spend the whole day counting it. But it was coming in trolley loads. There was just trolleys after trolleys. So, and it was just the most incredible time to live in. And this was 2008, not too long ago, and I've forgotten so much about it. There's a ludicrous thought that a $1 million note was worth more than one square of toilet paper. So it was cheaper to use money. Can you believe that? It's cheaper to use money when you went to the toilet. Because it was just beyond absurd. We just couldn't believe we were living in such an environment where it was just insane. Anyway, it came to an end at the end of 2009, where the only way they could stop the spiraling and inflation was just to cancel money. No more money. And they brought in the US dollar. And so we're still using just the US dollar. I think we're one of the only nations in the world. I think we are the only nation in the world that doesn't have our own currency. We have yours. And so that just immediately halted it, and we were able to trade, and it brought sanity back into the shops and into everything, and it bounced back reasonably in a very, very quick time. So now we still trade in US dollars. And just before I came here a week ago, because anything that was in your bank account on that day, they just took away. And so some people had some trillions of dollars in their bank, but it was just cancelled. So last week, the government got benevolent and they said, "Well, we're going to pay you that money that we took out their accounts." So everybody got a bit excited, and then you go down to the bank and they said, "Yeah, but there's an exchange rate here. So for every 35 quintillion you had, we're going to give you one US dollar." So not really worth it. That note that Chuck's now handing around, that's worth something. It's $30 on eBay. Not worth anything to buy anything, but it's worth $30 on eBay as a insurance policy. So through the journey of forgiveness and what we had been through, and then through this time, I began to reconnect with the founder of Foundations for Farming, a man named Brian Aldrieve, who since 1982 had been teaching this sustainable, faithful farming, stewardship of the land with the poor rural folks around the world, and especially in Africa. And so I began to reconnect, and I saw that God, in His grace and His amazing wisdom, had opened a door for me where I could now serve Africa in a real way. And so I came alongside him. It was called Farming God's Way then. His ministry was just him and his daughter and a couple of other guys. It was a very small ministry. He did everything himself. And I came along and I said to Brian, I said, I'd like to come and be your armor bearer here. And he said, well, I can't pay you anything. So I said, well, because I'd spent the previous 18 months trying to work out some financial plan for me to be able to go into ministry. And as God does, he doesn't, when you try and make a deal with him, it doesn't work. And so I went there and I said, well, I'm prepared to come and serve, and I don't care if I don't get paid, I'm just here. The minute I'd made that decision, a fellow from Seattle actually sent me some money, and I lived on it for quite a long time, probably about a whole year, American guy. So God knew, and he was teaching me, don't make a plan that is yours. I've got your provision in my hand. Don't make plans that aren't my plans. And so I started, and we suddenly grew into this relatively bigger, much bigger organization where we started teaching agriculture around Zimbabwe. Now, what it is actually is it's not about so much about agriculture and techniques. We've got a very simple technology based on zero tillage and no burning and leaving God's blanket, God's protective mulch on situ in the field. So the technology is very easy. It's just based on looking at God in nature and saying, going with a childlike faith and saying, Lord, teach me how to farm. That's how Brian learned the technology. He was faced with a situation of a farm going bankrupt through plowing and causing mass erosion and unsustainability and lack of profitability. So he went with a childlike faith into Virgin Bush, and he said to the Lord, he had been meditating on Romans 1, 18 to 22. It says, if you've seen creation, you have seen the Lord. You are without excuse. If you've seen a sunset, if you've seen a sunrise, you know that there's a God. And so he went there and he said, Lord, these trees have been alive for thousands of years or whatever, and they haven't died, and they haven't needed any fertilizer. How did you do it? And so he revealed to him two things. One, no inversion tillage, and secondly, this beautiful mulch cover that God uses to protect the soil from harsh effects of sunlight and rainfall and stuff like that. So he went back to his farm and he started to implement it, saw that it worked, and became a very, very successful farmer. Ended up doing 8,500 acres this way. But all the time he knew that the Lord had said to him, Brian, this isn't for you. I want you to transfer this technology to the rural poor. And so he obediently did, and he's done that for 33 years now with very little salary, and just poured his life out for the poor people of Africa. And so we have this very simple technology. We don't go into any great science. The grandmother out in the village, she wants to know how to feed her family. That's what's important to her. She doesn't need to know the science or cation exchange or pHs or potash. She doesn't need to know that stuff. She wants to feed her family. And so we go at a very low level. You know, God has an upside-down kingdom. You never get this kind of thing through the corridors of power and government. You go to the poor people at the bottom, and in God's upside-down way, it filters up. You know, when the Lord came, when Jesus came, he didn't go for the kings, the rulers, and the governors. He went and found 12 ordinary men and turned the world upside down. So we go there. We go, that's where God's called us, to the least, the last, and the lost. And so we have this simple technology, and then we've coupled it with a revealed from God. Everything we teach, not one thing comes out of our brain or our intellect. We do not conform to the standards of this world. We will allow God to completely renew our minds, and that, after all, is the answer, because he's the master farmer. He's got the solution to every problem the world has ever seen. We've just got to implement it faithfully and be faithful stewards of what he's given us. And so we do, we have an implementation management plan based on doing things on time, doing them to a very high standard, and doing them without wastage. If you do those three things, whether you're a farmer or not, whether you're a housewife or a teacher or a businessman or a bank manager, you do things on time and standard without wastage. If you do those three things, you will invariably be successful and you'll invariably be profitable, because we asked God, Brian asked God, what is it we have to do to get this implemented properly? He said, he felt the Lord saying to Brian, teach Africa to make a profit in every sphere. Because if you don't make a profit, there are only two avenues left for survival. You'll either beg or you'll steal. So from the smallest little small-scale farmer through to corporations, through to nations, through to continents, we have to earn more than we spend. And if you do those three things on time, at standard, without wastage, you will, and no matter what sphere of life you're in. And you know what happens when you do that? God gives you a fourth one for free, whether you like it or not, whether you're a believer or not. He gives it to you whether you like it or not, and that is joy. Joy comes. You can tell it to go away. It won't. If you've done something well on time and without wastage, you get a measure of joy. You, no matter what you are, who you are, whether you believe in God or not, you get joy. And that joy talks about the work ethic. It now gives you the desire to go out and work harder. Have you ever tried to work when you have no joy? It's impossible. But when you've got joy, you have a spring in your step, you're empowered, and you feel like going out and working harder. And then, of course, you do things on time and standard without wastage for again, and then God gives you some more joy. And so we teach people through a very simple technology, we teach them how to do things on time and standard without wastage with joy. But that is only 20% of it. That's still just a theory. We have to change the hearts of men and women. And so we spend 80% of our time pouring Jesus and the gospel into them. You will never get a behavior change in a village or in a person until you've had a heart change. You need a heart change before you get any behavior change. So we will spend 80% of our time just dealing with the heart issues, mentoring, discipling, loving the unlovable, pouring out. Mentoring and discipling means time. It means time. It means being unselfish with your time and just pouring into others instead of building for yourself. So we mentor and we disciple and we teach just God's heart, Jesus' heart. We believe that it's the character of Jesus that makes a difference in our lives. It's the character of Jesus that changes churches. It's the character of Jesus that changes our communities, it changes nations. Jesus didn't turn the world upside down with his good speaking voice or his good looks or his miracles even. It was his character. And we need to emulate his character. And his character is based on three attributes that we see. He was humble, he was unselfish, and he was faithful. So humble that he left the throne room of heaven to enter the belly of a teenager and be born in the filth of a stable. Ultimate act of humility. Then he poured his life out for 33 years. Unto death. Never a pillow to put his head on. Just served other people. Took the lowest place at the table. Served and served and served. Poured out his lifeblood to the end and died with absolute unselfishness. Died for us, for me and you. And then his faithfulness says, I only do what my Father told me to do. Absolute obedience. Humility, unselfishness, faithfulness. If we could all do that, we certainly wouldn't need governments. we wouldn't need prisons. We wouldn't need policemen. That's Jesus' character. And so when we want to follow Jesus' character, we want to see where he is. We don't try and make our own program and say, Jesus, come along with us, we're doing this. We go to where Jesus is working. And I want to submit to you that where Jesus looks down on any nation or any person, any community or any nation on the planet, he looks at the poor. That's where his heart is. Our entire ministry is rooted in chapter 58 of Isaiah, where the Lord was admonishing Israel. They were being religious. They were doing all the stuff. They were fasting and praying and everything, and they were saying to the Lord, "Why aren't you hearing our prayers?" And the Lord says back to them, "I don't want your outward religiosity, I want your heart. And if you pray and fast to me with a selfish heart, I do not hear you." Because they were doing all the religion, but then going home and oppressing their workers and pointing fingers and doing all that. And says, "I want to show you the true fast," says the Lord. And so he shows them the true fast. And paraphrased in Isaiah 58, the true fast, if you paraphrase it, is make a plan for the poor. Feed the hungry, clothe the naked, bring the homeless into your home. That's the simplicity of the gospel. That is the simplicity of what God would say. You see, we're born selfish. When I help someone, in the back of my mind, I'm perhaps thinking, well, maybe this guy can help me back someday. But when you go to the poorest of the poor, who can never help you back, your heart motive has been revealed. And it delights the Lord. And he says, this is the true fast I have chosen for you. And he says, if you do that, then he comes out with his amazing promises. Your light will break forth like the dawn. The righteousness will go before you. The glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. You'll be like a well-watered garden. Its waters never fail. You will be known as the rebuilders on ancient ruins. But where does it start? God's heart, making a plan for the poor. So we go to where God's working, and we use agriculture as an entry point, beautiful entry point, because in Africa so many people are hungry. But in America, every nation has its poor. There's poor wherever you go. It might not be physically, it just looks different in different nations. But people who are in bondage to alcohol and stuff, they're poor. And so we've all got poor around us that God would want us to minister to. Because we know it's so dear to his heart. When you look at the four greatest church eras or moves of Christianity ever on this planet, they reveal God's heart for the poor. The first stage was Jesus being born. He identified himself with the poor by being born in filth. Then after 33 years of preparation, Jesus goes back to his home church in Nazareth, pulls out the scroll and reads from Isaiah 61. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. I've been anointed to preach the good news to who? The poor." He tells the people why he's come for the poor, physically and in spirit, and the brokenhearted. So he tells, when he announces his ministry, he announces why he's come. And then for us who are in the Gentile church, the next great move of God, when Paul and Barnabas went to Jerusalem, they had hands laid on them, and the apostles said, "We're going to stay and minister to the Jews. We want you to go out and minister to the Gentiles." Of all the teaching of Jesus, of all the scriptures, of all the things they could have said, they gave one instruction and one instruction only. 2 Galatians 10 tells us, they said, "Don't forget the poor." So the church we are sitting in today was birthed on one instruction: don't forget the poor. And then, of course, in Matthew 25, when he talks about the millennium, when he talks about separating people, sheep from goats, the criteria: that you did to the least of my brothers. You see how close the poor is to God's heart. I think, if you put on God's lenses and you look down on a nation, the first people he sees are the poor. And we as his servants, we as his hands and feet, we as Christian brothers and sisters, that's where we need to go first. I submit that to you for something to meditate on. To make a priority in your heart, to make a plan for the poor. Make a plan for the least, the last, and the lost. Because they're around us. They're around us. We just have to find them, and God will put them in our path. And to be able to be Jesus' hands and feet, we have to have this compassion and love for the unlovable sometimes. But the poor can be very precious to you if you allow God to break you and give you a heart for the poor, because that's where His heart is. So, I hope I've just given you something for you to chew on, something for you to meditate on. Jesus' heart for the poor. And He used a prideful man like me, and He had to break me in order to use me. And I could have fled. I could have, but I chose the hardest option, which was to forgive. And I'm so grateful to Him today that I'm able to be in front of you, and today I'm reaping songs of joy, the promises of Psalm 126. Sow in your tears, and you shall reap songs of joy. Can I pray for you? Father God, I just thank you for these precious people. I thank you for every heart here tonight. I pray that hearts would be open and receptive, and even hours and days and months after this message, it would still be something to chew on. Because, Lord, you love us so much. You love us beyond that we can even dream, hope, or imagine how much you love us. And yet, we are sometimes just so wretched before you. Will you forgive us, Lord? Forgive me, Father, for my leaning on pride, not conforming to your standards, but conforming to what the world tells me to do. Your thoughts are higher than ours, Lord. And so I pray for every heart here. I pray for this church. I pray for this town. I pray for this nation. This nation that has been such a beacon of Christianity for the whole world. People that we could all look up to, this great nation of America. And as we see the moral fiber beginning to tear, we ask, Lord, you'd have mercy. You'd have mercy on the people of America, and I just pray for them, every citizen, and say thank you. I pray that my words, coming from a weak and foolish nation, you know, Father, that you use the weak and foolish sometimes to confound the wise. So I pray that my words have found a home, have found traction in the hearts of your servants tonight. In Jesus' precious name I pray. Amen.